Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. Welcome. I hope you're doing well today. If you were with us last week, you remember we had Holly Amberg on the program. And if you remember, she is an 81-year-old retired photographer out of Albuquerque, she's in Arizona. And she discovered what appears to be a lost civilization in the northern deserts of Chile at Atacama Desert. And I got an email from her just after the program, and it turns out that she's found another civilization further south in that region of that desert. And, you know, it's funny. I haven't really talked about Google Earth at all. And Holly used Google Earth primarily not only to find the remains of a civilization that has not been identified, that has not been researched and excavated. And she's waiting, as well as I am, probably thousands of other people are waiting to see what has been found out there. But her primary source, Holly's primary source of investigation, was a tool that Google Earth offers for free. And if you don't know anything about Google Earth, I really suggest that you get on your computer and check it out. It was developed originally for the CIA. and it's a tool that takes software, the systems built into satellites, and converts it into an easy to use system for the viewer to see the surface of the Earth from miles above the ground. Now, I have been using Google Earth for a number of years. I use it when I'm interested in looking at a ruin. For me, primarily in Central America, the Maya area, and a lot of the old Mexican areas of Central America. And you got to check it out, because what you can do is you can actually zoom in to up to a few hundred feet above buildings and landscapes and agricultural areas. And what Holly did is she was just kind of playing around with it, and she discovered what she now calls Nuevo Albergues, New Albergues after her name, by just scanning sections of the desert, checking out areas of interest, and then focusing down on them. And the tool is such that not only did she make significant discoveries, but there's been a number of actual academic archaeologists who have found new pyramids, new pyramid areas, new structures in Egypt, unknown regions of agriculture in African area, Africa areas, as well as structures in South America. And so it's a free software application. All you have to do is download it. You don't need a lot of memory. You do need a little bit of computing power. So your CPU, your processing application needs to be at least the latest. I think if you're running Windows 7 and you're processing data through that, I think that's pretty good. But maybe an earlier software application would be fine for that. Windows 8 is what a lot of people are running. I don't like Windows 8. I like Windows 7 just because it runs a little seamlessly. It doesn't have so many pop-ups. But when you look at the Earth from a satellite's point of view, it's a very different place. And on a personal note, I have found unusual formations in known ruins, like Chichen Itza, which is a very famous Mayan ruin in northern Yucatan, Mexico, has only been excavated about 15%. So 15% of the main buildings have been consolidated and cleaned up and are available for viewing. But there's huge areas that surround those consolidated areas that have not been excavated. And that goes for most of the Mayan ruins in Central America and in Yucatan specifically. The archaeologists will go after the areas that are most prevalent, most easy to see, and excavate and reconstruct those areas. But there's a lot that's underground. And the unique part of seeing these areas from a satellite perspective is they give off signatures. And when I say signatures, there's surface reliefs. There is patterns that are not discussed in a lot of journals because they don't recognize them. They're not looking at them from an elevated point of view. So, you know, if you get a chance, download the software, pick an area that you're interested in, and zoom down from 10, 20 miles above to closer to the surface and see what you find. You might find something that is unique. And then you may, like Holly, be able to proclaim your discovery. But it's just something else. I mean, it's just something else to check out. It's a new way to explore. You know, it's going beyond the boundaries of convention. And I strongly urge you to check it out. So yeah, satellite exploration is very cool. Mike Berra, last week, Mike was our featured presenter. His book is now out on, it's digitally available, Ancient Aliens and Sacred Societies. Strangely enough, it seems like the term Ancient Aliens was something the publisher put on there because there isn't a great deal of talk about aliens. And we all know how I feel about this discussion of aliens in ancient history. But I really urge you to check that book out. I had a chance to look in it a little deeper, and his references to the moon and the Mars and some of the artifacts that he lists in the book are fascinating and currently up to date. And yes, there is archaeology on the moon. There is archaeology on Mars. And although it's not discussed officially, we know from Dr. Brandenburg in our discussions that NASA does know they exist but is unwilling to divulge the information. So as independent researchers, as curiosity seekers, we have to kind of look at it on our own, go above and beyond what the official statements are regarding the moon and regarding Mars. So anyhow, Mike Baer's book, Ancient Alien, Aliens, and Secret Societies is a great read. And I strongly urge you to have a look at it. As always, I'm encouraging everyone to check out the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook. There is sections constantly being updated. I posted a unique article on Sacsayhuaman in Peru, which is just above Cusco. And there is an article called 10 Incredible Images of Sacsayhuaman You Probably Haven't Seen. And I think you'll see quickly why they are incredible images. Some of the stonework is very similar to dynastic Egypt. Some of the structures are unbelievably precise in their development and how they were cut. And above all, there is, according to a number of engineers, some kind of a lost science in how these a lot of these stones were cut. They're not cut with anything that we know about. They're not chiseled. They're not sawed with blades. They seem to be cut with high heat or high intensity heat of some kind, because there's a vitrification or a sheen that's left on a lot of these stones. And this brief article, 10 Incredible Images of Sacsayhuaman, actually reveals a lot of this stone masonry that is very, very unique. So take a look at that. That was posted just a few days ago, and it's a good introduction to some of the anomalous construction that is found in Peru. I have been a person that's sought, as a lot of us have in our youth, different levels of consciousness, and for me, I began to kind of delve into Eastern philosophy in my early 20s, and later started experimenting with certain types of meditation techniques. And in the early 1980s, when I was in high school, I graduated high school, I was in early college, there was a lot of drug use, and it was a form of experimentation to, I believe, achieve different levels of consciousness for enjoyment. But I think people were also exploring. And I think there was a prevalence in America in the 1980s and the early 70s too, where people were seeking ways to access consciousness through psychedelics. But there was also a movement of people seeking alternative forms of consciousness through meditative practices, through devotion, through prayer, things like that. And for me, I began studying the works of an Indian sage named Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who founded Transcendental Meditation, which is TM, Transcendental Meditation. And for me, it was I smoked the marijuana. I did stuff like that. I admit it, but it didn't do anything for me. It wasn't. It was too overwhelming, and I needed stuff that was more subtle. I needed a practice that was more subtle. So in my 20s, I started doing a form of meditation, and for me, it was a great relief for stress. And into my adult life, I continue the practice, and to this day, I still meditate and find it a way to get through the long days, the stress, the accumulation of issues around just living. But there's other forms of consciousness. Alcohol, drinking alcohol changes your consciousness. And there's other ways to shift consciousness. We know that Graham Hancock has written extensively on using not only cannabis, but other more powerful levels of consciousness changing drugs to shift out of our daily awareness and to look through the eyes of these enhancers to see what the reality is, what different realities come about. And my guest today has written a book about higher consciousness in the form of myths. Now, this is an interesting book because what they propose, the author proposes, is that the ancients were able to create myths, and through the reading of the myths, and we'll find out specifically, I'm just giving you my quick interpretation, we'll bring our author on here in a second, but it appears to me that there are other forms of consciousness development, consciousness access that the ancients knew that we really don't understand. And my guest today is Paul Boudreau, who is a ecologist, biologist, and has studied ancient myths and traveled extensively through the Middle East and has studied the Egyptian temples. And Paul and his co-author, Lloyd Dickey, have written a book called Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt in Sumer. And it's unique to think about. I mean, a lot of this program, Earth Ancients, is based on an interest on ancient Egypt, ancient Sumer, and a lot of the wisdom that they left us, but there's so much of this wisdom we just don't know about. And so today we're going to talk about consciousness from the eyes of the ancients. And welcome to the program, Paul.
Hello, Cliff. How are you?
Great. Now, you're calling from where now? What part of the world are you located at?
I'm on the other side of the continent, on the east coast of Canada, somewhere north of, say, Boston. Over in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia, right. And how, I'm here in California, how's the weather there these days? Are you guys having normal weather, or is it odd like a lot of the states here?
We're in the one blue spot on the NASA charts. We've had a cold winter, but today the daffodils are out and it's 50 degrees, which for our neighborhood is really quite pleasant.
Oh, excellent. Glad to hear it. So this is an interesting book. What was yours and Lloyd's motivation to write a book on higher consciousness? I'm just curious, because in your early part of your book, mm-hmm. there's images of you and Lloyd around the Great Pyramids and other structures. I'm curious as to what would motivate an academic scientist like you guys to do something like this, to write something like this?
I think we'd have to go back to our childhood, and I know we're going to come back to consciousness and relate that to early experience, but Lloyd and I, we worked as marine ecologists, and we spent many days at sea studying fish off of the North Atlantic coast and various scientific studies, but we both discovered in our conversations that we've had some sort of childhood experiences where we heard stories and nursery rhymes that just, I don't know, they just didn't make sense. And I guess in some ways, sort of just started that flow of thought of what could they possibly mean. You know, I mean, take the Garden of Eden, which we write about in our book. I mean, what, why would a story about naked people in the garden be passed down for 5,000 years, and why would I care? So the original beginnings of our curiosity went back well before we met, and once we got together and had time in the back of a fishing boat or sitting in on the west bank of Egypt, we just sort of encouraged each other to sort of explore really what could be behind these myths that really didn't make sense to us. You know, even nursery rhymes. I don't know if you had the chance to sing nursery rhymes when you were a kid, but I remember singing the nursery rhyme, Ring Around the Rosie. Do you know that nursery rhyme?
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Right. Well, it was many years later I found out, well, it came from the Great Plague in the mid-1600s. And you, I, here we are still singing that nursery rhyme without having that connection of, well, why would we be singing about the Great European Plague? Mm-hmm. So that showed that myths do have this power to carry this information forward. Our challenge is to figure out, well, what does it mean to us today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what was the importance of myths created by the ancients? Was it to carry down certain kinds of information? Was it a form of teaching that was used? And what did you guys discover?
Well, early on, we, you know, obviously we were talking about myths, and Lloyd certainly has had the interest in Egypt for many years and introduced me to it. And we were kind of struck at how the early explorers sort of labeled, let's talk about the Egyptian myths for a second, but labeled Egyptian myths spells or incantations or in a very derogatory, dismissive way. And they were a product of their time, much like we are of our time. So I guess I'm not surprised that they did that, but I see that we're still trying to get past those initial impressions that labeled these myths, what is in fact great literature, that it was labeled as a, you know, a throwaway, not of importance. And so the more we looked at it, the more we found we could relate those myths to what we are today, and not just ancient myths of ancient times with, you know, gods throwing thunderbolts and you know, all the classical sort of myth kind of things. But the more we looked and the more we dug into some of the early literature, it became obvious to us that it really was trying to provide a language to themselves as to what they were, how could they engage in life and engage in consciousness. So this fascinated us, of course, and that sort of set us on a path to sort of explore ancient Egyptian, Sumerian, the Hebrew myths, etc. Mm-hmm. So it came up very naturally, and we're still working on it today.
Okay. You reference the work of Schwalo Dulubich and his Sacred Geometry, which is a fascinating read. Of course, John Anthony West, in his book, mm-hmm. Serpent in the Sky, is the greatest recount of his work, Dulubich's mm-hmm. work. But did you discover a sacred form of writing in the hieroglyphs that you discovered and read? And is this, because we're the focus here is consciousness and consciousness rising, higher levels of consciousness. Was there mm-hmm. something that you discovered in these myths that triggers a level of consciousness that we're not aware of? Or was it more just for you, both the recounting of ancient myths that is an important factor?
Well, I think the best way to capture it, I think it's hidden in plain sight. I think in many cases we're familiar with the images. It's just that we don't address the images in a way that it's useful to us. And as an example, in the book, we talk about four levels of interpretation of myth. We there's many ways to look at it, but we talk about literal, allegorical, hieroglyphic, and esoteric. And we think that all myths potentially have all those levels of interpretation. A good myth has all of those levels. I mean, literal, it's got to be interesting to people to carry it forward. And if I may, my example that I use with people is, on the literal level, a wolf is an animal. A wolf is a wolf. It has sharp teeth. I mean, yeah, one can picture a wolf, but allegorically or figuratively, you know, a wolf could be a person who's preying on someone or a person who's a bad influence. So that's a different level than thinking, you know, there's a wolf in my backyard and whatnot. The challenge comes about when you start getting into the hieroglyphic and esoteric, or I guess what Schwarzschild Lubitz called the symbolic. You know, to try to get to those deeper meanings, on a hieroglyphic level, it's not so apparent what is meant, and what the person brings to the myth is probably as important as what the myth conveys. One has to be engaged. So the wolf in Red Riding Hood, again, another simple myth, is an influence that caused her life to change. It gave her a great loss because poor Granny got eaten, but it gave rise to maturity, and she met the hunter and went on. So all myths, I think, contain these various levels. And what we try to do in the book is to, in some cases, re-explore myths that people are familiar with, but other cases introduce new myths that we can use to look at these various levels. And the literal is easy. The higher levels are more difficult, much like, I guess, consciousness. So, but Schwarzschild-Lubitz definitely was a huge influence. I mean, his looking at the Egyptian myths was critical to pulling away from this misunderstanding, false concept that all the Egyptian wrote about was death. Many people I talk to, they think, the Egyptians were just a funerary society. And we don't think so. We think that they were struggling with developing a language to express the higher levels of consciousness that they were aware of. Another great influence on us has been Jeremy Nadler, Dr. Jeremy Nadler, who wrote a book called The Shamanic Wisdom Restored. Mm-hmm. He looked at the pyramid text. I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but he looked at the pyramid text as a description of not the development of the pharaoh after he died, but Jeremy makes a very convincing case to us that they were actually talking about transformation while alive. What better way to capture this whole concept of describing awakening higher consciousness is to, passage through the netherworld, passage through the Dwat. So do we find something secret or sacred? I think it's there, and we have to harvest it and find out how to approach it.
Okay. In Serpent in the Sky, John Anthony West's book, he uncovers an ancient wisdom, which Dlugacz actually reveals as sacred geometry. Did mm-hmm. you discover a higher level of intelligence in these myths, a form of intelligence that we can actually detect in the Egyptian interpretation, in Egyptian myths?
I mean, Lloyd and I have played with sacred geometry as well, and it's the whole trying to get your head around phi and what that relationship is coming from Schwarzschild-Lubitz is still an interesting challenge. Again, there's no prescription. I think we have to take what we can, and again, in the book, we look at the book of Genesis, and we think that there are lessons in there that help us appreciate that those creation moments of consciousness so that we can help remember for ourselves. A big part of our writing has to do with direct experience. So it's a matter of being within oneself and having the ability to be aware of what's going on. And then the myths can help by providing some wording that will help us understand and be present at that time. Because without words, it's hard to see what's going on, whether that's inside us or outside us.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the myths play a role.
But would you interpret the the individuals who wrote these myths as highly intelligent, average intelligence, or tapping into a level of consciousness that we haven't achieved yet?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I have the utmost respect for them. I mean, their ability to capture these thoughts. Again, go back to the concept of netherworld or the Duat. You know, I mean, a parallel plane of existence that one travels through to become initiated and come back. I mean, we have trouble even today sort of capturing that kind of context. And in the world we live in now, which is very engineered and mechanistic, and, we don't have that language that allows us to sit down and talk to one another about this experience. I think in the there are cultures in the world that still value that, you know, shamanistic development, whereas, you know, it's undervalued in certainly Western culture. So, yes, I think they were very highly developed. I think that although we're separated by 5,000 years, I think we're probably essentially the same people, the same over evolution. We haven't changed that much. So in our work, to be able to touch what they were touching is, I think, something that's very doable. It just takes time, effort, and probably a lifetime of effort for that. But yeah, I think they are us and we are them.
But don't you think in our mechanized world, our world with internet access and attention deficit disorders because we're all locked into our smartphones, that we've lost something in terms of the ability to achieve a higher consciousness that maybe the ancients had just because of their culture?
Definitely, I think they had stronger support for it. I mean, you see the amazing constructions that the Egyptians did, and when you look at some of the writing that the Sumerians did, at least 5,000 years later, it appears that sort of cultural support was built into their lifetime. Excuse me. Much like now, we have cultural support for, you know, indoor plumbing and heating, but I think there's always challenges, and I wish I could capture for myself what my biggest challenge is, but even seeing my own operation, I want to lose weight, but I want to eat a piece of cake. Well, sometimes I win and I don't eat the piece of cake, but sometimes the cake wins. And I'm sure that has persisted throughout the ages.
Interesting. I was fascinated by your study of the myths in this book, and you make an interesting statement. You say that myths are an important vehicle in building a civilization. Why don't you explain to our audience what that means? How do myths help in building a civilization?
Let me turn it around a bit, if I may. Are you familiar with a book by William Sullivan on the Incas? You mentioned the Incas in your introduction.
Oh yeah.
To America. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book on how the Incan myths captured what they were observing in the sky and the precession of the equinox and their strong connection with between the myths and their observation of the sky. What Sullivan does is he makes the point that this strong connection, this strong belief that they held actually preconditioned them to be taken over by the conquistadors. Now, I'm not an expert, but I love that image whereby that whole culture was based on something that had predicted an end, and when the strange Spanish guys arrived, this huge culture allowed it to happen, whereas in pure logic, from 21st century logic, it makes no sense at all. But he does a very good job of showing how, in that case, the culture came to an end because of faith and belief. If I may, the Egyptians, people, marvel at the pyramids, which are fantastic structures. And you know, I still chuckle when people suggest that that they were built by slaves. I mean, it's mind-boggling how one could even suggest that slaves, with you know all the conditions of slavery, could build such beautiful, perfect constructions. It'd be like making asking a slave to create a Stradivarius violin. It just doesn't make sense to me. So obviously, to do to build a pyramid and the temples and the tombs in ancient Egypt, I'm sure required a buy-in from the average Egyptian right up to the pharaoh. Much like you know we're exploring Mars and we're sending satellites out. That takes the full support of our present-day society, which highly values that kind of construction and that kind of effort. Whereas we, I don't know, an alternate, maybe we don't value seeing the sunset as much. Maybe is that a good example? You know, yeah. The society makes choices, and that those choices can be seen in its creations.
Interesting. Let's talk about some of these very old, if not ancient, myths, and see where we go here. Tell us a little bit about the Sumerian creation myth. That's a fascinating myth, and what are they hoping the reader to extract from that myth?
If I may, Cliff. I'd like to step back just a little bit because I'm not sure how familiar your audience is with Sumer and Sumerian. Can I digress for a few minutes and come back to that?
Sure.
One challenge that I've had growing up is that in my education, I was taught that present day culture has derived primarily from the ancient Greeks. Does that sound strange to you? Is it?
No, that's one of the problems that I have is that that is supposed to be our inception point in terms of culture. But go ahead.
All right. Well, so, I mean, democracy is meant to be coming down from the Greeks.
Right.
Well, and this was always a problem because Lloyd and I were looking at, you know, the Egyptians and Sumerians, and we're trying to figure out, well, why the Greeks? You know, why we were finding, you know, great we were finding examples of civilization and higher knowledge in the earlier times. And the best we can come up with is it seems to be that the Greeks get all the credit because we understood Greek. Simple as that. You know, the Greek and Latin got translated down into English and whatnot. And the Egyptian and Sumerian languages weren't really even known or understood or anywhere near close to being decoded until a couple hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think this has given a big disservice to both Sumerian and Egyptian because the late Greeks sort of certainly were trained in Egypt. You know, the predecessors to Aristotle and Plato, they all went to Egypt and studied from the masters in Egypt. But, of course, they didn't quite pass along all the credit down to the preceding time. So in terms of Sumer, which was 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years B.C., 3,000 years before Greece, what's coming out of the literature now is a very refined, a highly refined culture, which included making laws, teaching, you know, schools for teaching kids. Their literature was highly evolved. And the story of paradise, the concept of paradise, the story of the flood, all go back to Sumer 5,000 years ago. And I think it's a big. I think there's a lot of benefit in going back to some of their actual literature to see how they captured these ideas. I love the intro to the show today on Google Earth. You know, I mean that's a tool that you encourage people to use, and it's a great tool. Well, there's a tool online now for the Sumerian literature. It's called the Electronic Textual Corpus ETCSL. If you just do a Google or Bing search on ECTSL. It comes out of Oxford.
ECTSL, okay. Go ahead.
it comes out of Oxford University, and it's got a listing of all of the known literature from Sumer. So one can go online and access this information that just didn't exist a couple hundred years ago. The same thing with the pyramid text. Again, it's from the same time period, 4,500 years ago, 5,000 years ago. The pyramid text were found inside one of the earliest, some of the very earliest pyramids ever built. A couple hundred years ago, nobody knew what it meant. And now, online, if you do a search of pyramid text online, sorry, I'm a bit of a techie geek, pyramid text online, and you can see the actual text, you can see the translation. And so those tools, I think, we have to make better use of. And our book is, you know, obviously our first attempt to try to look at the real thing, the real information, the real pictures on the wall. So that those are great resources that, you know, I can't say enough about. We couldn't have gotten anywhere without that kind of resource. So when you go back and look at the ETCSL, or, you know, the Sumerian literature, you find a lot of the common themes that I know others have written about. I don't know if you've had guests on to talk about the origin of the flood story, you know, those sorts
of things. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And they come from 5,000 years ago. And so getting back to basics of myth, we contend that myths contain real information. And the real information exists on many levels. And we think that in most myths, many myths, there's some higher level information there that's useful. So you asked about creation myth. Well, we look at the creation myths of Sumer and Egypt, but the most useful thing that I've gotten out of our study of creation myths is its ability to draw my own personal attention to those moments of awakening, those moments of creation. And I think of creation not in the sense of physical, you know, the ground we stand on or even the universe. That's an interesting question. But for me, in studying the Sumerian text, it sort of provided a language to help me understand those moments of awakening. I don't know if you've had one or had them, but in my life, I've had a number of moments when it was like, wow, I'm here. And they come up, they often come out of nowhere, and they're generally overwhelming. You know, it's like, where was I before?
Would you say that awareness that you're talking about is that you are a physical being, or is it more just, here I am, and these are my surroundings, and wow, it's cool. Well, can you explain that a little bit more?
It's got to be both, because we are both. It's partly, you know, what I'm tasting, what I'm smelling, what I'm feeling, but also at the same point, feeling more than that. You know, simple example is driving down the road late at night, and something happens, and all of a sudden it's, my God, where was I? And here I am. And within seconds, it's over, and I'm scrambling to make sense of it. But those moments of awakening are very powerful moments in my life. And so the whole idea of creation out of the void, the undifferentiated mass, those kind of phrases that we encountered in the Sumerian myths do a very nice job of capturing for me a memory of what happened before those events. And, you know, the separation of the water from the earth. Again, these are phrases that I found very useful in my own life to say, yeah, those happened, and the phrases helped me remember.
Interesting. So can we talk a little bit about the Sumerian creation myth and its importance? I'd be interested in learning a little bit about what you discovered about that and how it may trigger consciousness.
Well, we encounter in Sumerian creation somewhat of a similar theme as in the Bible, the Genesis story, in terms of, in the very distant times, there was nothing differentiated. Everything was the same. And then you've got something happens, something stirs, something separates the earth from the water and from the earth from the heavens. We publish an image which again shows this mountain rising out of the water, similar to the Egyptian. We could get into the names and whatnot, but that general impression of a void which somehow starts to generate something, to me is a very good analogy, a very good description of my own experience of those moments of awakening.
Okay.
What do you?
Well, I mean, we've had a lot of guests on the program who have spoken about Enki and the other gods and their stories, and of course, this gets into the 12th planet, which is Zachariah Sitchin's work. But I'm just curious about what you discovered in your interpretations of these myths, from your perspective, how it's a higher level of consciousness in either speaking, reading, or interpreting this myth.
Well, I'm more interested in my own world, I guess, I understand that a lot of people look at external interpretations of where we might have come from and et cetera, et cetera. For me, it really has to do with describing my development and, finding that analogy for Anne and Enlil, the sweet water and the earth inside of me, I guess, as I go through. So it could be that these myths are talking about, the external world, but again, we come back to sort of using those words and trying to apply those words to my internal world to see if they help me better follow and see what I do. I think that's one of the challenges of experiencing higher consciousness. Again, as this your intro, and I'm not going to confess to anything here, but when one is sober and living life to the fullest. I agree with you. One gets very distracted and overwhelmed when maybe one's using other things. And that's probably why Hancock strongly recommends strong guidance when he's talking about some of the stimulants that he suggested. So to taste those other dimensions, and to be able to work daily on trying to contact them, I think is a very important task for me. We talk about, there are many books written on shamans and the shaman in the cult community that's able to regularly or deliberately touch these other levels. In my understanding, they are going through this creation quite deliberately in a way that I certainly cannot. But I think that they're touching a plane of consciousness that the ancient myths have really tried to capture in their myths. And I think that's partly why some of these stories are still being told 5,000 years later.
Interesting. Probably the most well-known, if not famous, Sumerian story is the Epic of Gilgamesh. Mm-hmm. And you have it in your book. And I'm just curious what your interpretation of that myth is and how it may trigger a sense of the past or the future or as human beings, what is the effect of that because it's a fascinating story.
It is indeed, and for more reasons than just the fact that it was the first flood story from so long ago. The Gilgamesh story is really a story of, I guess, the way we see it is the balancing of two sides of my personality, or anyone's personality. So you've got Gilgamesh, who's half god, and in our general concept of god, you know, again, thunderbolts on a cloud, we have a difficult time appreciating why Gilgamesh should have so much trouble doing what he's doing. I mean, he starts a story and he's causing great havoc. But he really doesn't become an effective person or a whole person or more a whole person until Enkidu comes in. And Enkidu is the wild, hairy beast from the forest who really is closer to an animal, I guess, than a human. And once they're balanced, once they work together, once they appreciate each other, they seem to be able to accomplish great things. They kill the bull of Hedvin, they cut down Humbaba. And so, again, we come back to this whole idea of direct experience and what that means for me internally in terms of seeing my God side and seeing my Enkidu side. You know, I've already mentioned the piece of cake. I think everybody can appreciate that. We're not just whole beings. We're not just one. We have these different sides, and we see Gilgamesh as a very important description of that kind of, I was going to say internal turmoil, but it's more than that. The internal blending that can happen if we actually balance our two sides, they can accomplish great things. As the story progresses, of course, Enkidu dies, and it's very significant that Gilgamesh, this half god, who by all intents and purposes should be quite happy, is feeling this strong yearning for immortality. And again, that's I'm not sure I'm aiming for immortality, but I certainly feel my immortality. So the final vignette for the story is, of course, he is successful. He marshals his godlike. He goes across the sea. He gets the flower of immortality, and wouldn't you know it, he falls asleep. And if that doesn't describe my best intentions, I don't know what is.
It seems that a lot of what you're describing is human function and human frailties, and is that kind of what your basis of the book is to explain the human condition and the importance of understanding the human condition and not just go about your daily 9-to-5 mm-hmm. existence to step above beyond just the daily activities of our life, and why absolutely. The ancients kind of understood that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Understand our frailties, but also our potential. You know, mm-hmm. again, this whole idea of the Osiris myth is Osiris was able to travel through the netherworld and be reborn as a special person in the Egyptian culture. So absolutely, Cliff, that's a good summary. There's so much more for us to see inside of ourselves, and the myths provide us with some venues to actually explore that. Yeah, I mean, no question, I'm also interested in, you know, some of the other studies that are going on, you know, but Robert Schock and the Sphinx and Bouval and John Anthony West you mentioned, and Laird Scranton. I mean, those are also interest me, but in terms of our study and our contribution to this whole, you know, moving our understanding of ourselves forward, we look at that personal side and how that's seen in the myths as opposed to external things. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
It does. Can you, I mean, I like to always give my audience some tools or suggestions based on the book. And of course, we're going to refer people to the book, Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. But if you were to give somebody a suggestion or an idea about what you've discovered and how they can better maybe possibly access the humanity of them of themselves? What would you suggest they do in reading these? I mean, is there a suggestion for some reading? Obviously, your book is a good starting point, but are you hoping that people just gain greater awareness? Or are you suggesting that by reading these myths, they are, in your estimation, tapping into a higher consciousness?
I think that's possible. You mentioned meditation, and I meditate on my own form, and I couldn't describe that to anybody else. But you know, reading myths, exploring them, teasing out the personal, the direct experience from them is what I'd recommend, rather than reading them. Well, before you go to sleep, you're already asleep, but before you go especially asleep at night, I think there's a real benefit to becoming more active in reading these myths as, again, as a literature, as words. You know, it's fine. If I told you that, you know, I had a lovely apple this morning and I bit into a crisp apple and the air was cool, you'd have a sense of what I mean. Mm-hmm. Harder for me to explain, oh yeah, that was a moment when I was aware. That was a moment when I was more than I am now. That discussion is more difficult, and certainly for me, you've practiced more than I maybe, but so that's what I would recommend is that these myths are a useful tool to draw you out of your sleep and to actually apply those myths to actually see what's going on in you. The Gurdjieff work, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they talk about the many eyes, and we're not one. And the first challenge for us to improve is to see all these eyes. It's something we write about one of our later books, but I have been a marathoner, and one summer, like many marathoners, I was trying to qualify for the Boston Marathon. And I took it upon myself to count every step as I ran, sort of like a mantra, you know, every step, every second I counted. And I did it for the whole summer, you know, tens of thousands of steps. But there were two or three instances on that summer that it was incredible. I saw the person, me, who was counting, one, two, three. I saw the person in me that was running, breathing. I also saw a complainer in me that said, oh, you don't need to count. You counted enough. You give it a break. You don't need to do this. And then on top of that, I saw someone that could appreciate it all. So that concept of the many eyes is a very real experience of me, for me. And reading these myths, of course, highlights that, no, that I wasn't crazy. I wasn't delusional as I ran. But these are real events, and others have tried to describe these kind of other awarenesses, these other levels of consciousness, and and so that, for me, it's been very useful to at least read somebody else trying to describe with great difficulty those kind of events. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I'm working on it, but yeah, it does. In its simplest form, what you and Lloyd discovered, would you say that you have discovered a level of humanity that hasn't been discussed before by reading these ancient myths? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's been missed. When we read about the creation and separating heaven and earth, we look at those words and we imagine some distant time when there's a hot, cold planet sort of developing. I think we slip into the literal, and because that's easy. That's fine. You look at Gilgamesh. Oh, yeah, he was a big, strong guy, and he went off and did great things with Enkidu. it's tougher to get to those higher levels of understanding, the levels that Sweller de Lubitz mentioned. You know, for centuries, people had looked at the Sphinx and the pyramids and, wow, that's great. But until Sweller was able to apply a different perspective on the, well, not only just construction, but his wife, Ilsa, on the language, they were just buildings. They weren't, you know, they didn't convey the same meaning that he was able to come up. And what right. he does when I read Sweller de Lubitz is that challenge is, yes, I have to put more into reading these. I can't just sit back and, you know, and dream. I have to actually work on sacred geometry. I have to, you know, apply myself to myself, not just to externally.
I guess that's my interest is that perhaps the ancients understood physiology, human physiology, better than we do today, and they perhaps needed to be in a state of mind when reading these texts that mm-hmm. maybe shifted consciousness. Mm-hmm. As an example, you cannot be too excited. You cannot mm-hmm. be drinking stimulants. You cannot be upset before you read these myths.
Right.
And then in the quieted state of mind, when you read through these documents, then a form of meditative consciousness is brought forth. What do you think about that idea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right on. If we look at the pyramid text, they were written on the wall, inside walls of a pyramid. At the time of, you know, the fourth dynasty, 5,000 years ago. The pyramids themselves are always part of a pyramid complex. There's a point to this, if you allow.
No, of course.
The pyramid complex is made up of the pyramid, no question. I mean, this big pointy thing with made of huge rocks. But it's also made up of an enclosing wall, which surrounded the pyramid. There's a pyramid temple in which you enter the pyramid. There is a long causeway that, again, if you go to Google Earth, you'll see each of the pyramids, most of the pyramids, you can see the causeway that connected the pyramid to the valley temple. And there's a valley temple on the side of the Nile. And to get into the pyramid, where these pyramid texts are written all over the wall, the person, let's say the pharaoh, would have had to start down at the Valley Temple. He would arrive by boat, most likely. He would have to go through this enclosed causeway, which one can't touch or see at the moment. They're destroyed. So he'd have to go like a mile and a half inside this enclosed causeway. And in terms of one of the pyramids, in particular the Pyramid of Unas, there was a slit up the top of the roof of the causeway. So he'd be traveling up this enclosed area, and all he could see above was just a narrow band of the sky. Then he gets to the temple, where I would assume he would do temple-y kind of things, before entering the pyramid and going down into the chambers. So absolutely, by the time he was exposed to the pyramid text written on the walls, he would have had to do this very extraordinary journey through various physical sites. And I mean, of course, he would have to be in a special condition of calm and preparation before he would even encounter the texts. And I would be sure that state of preparation would be essential to what he would get over. Have you ever managed to get into one of the pyramids?
I'm sorry to say, have not been there yet, and I got to get over there. I've been spent most of my time in ancient Central America, but from everything I've read and what a number of close friends have described, is some of the structures there are so awe-inspiring that you're shifted whether you like it or not. So,
absolutely. To be in the middle of a pyramid is such a calm and reassuring but earth-shattering place to be in the world. Lloyd and I have done that a couple of times. And so, yes, absolutely. That's a special place to be reading any kind of book, let alone a book about transformation and mysticism and initiation.
So we're getting close to the end of our program here. I wanted to ask you, and you may not be able to address this, but I brought it up earlier, but I'm just curious that if you and Lloyd, in your research of these texts, of these myths, were able to get a sense of what the Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, these ancient cultures prized in consciousness. Do you think that they understood levels of consciousness as we do today? In other words, we have all these electronics that we can measure the state of someone's brain waves in a meditative state, in a waking state, in a concentration, and a thinking state. Do you think that the ancients understood the importance of this?
Yeah, I've been reading a bit on obviously people trying to understand brain functioning and whatnot. The Egyptians thought the heart, the soul of a person resided in the heart. I don't think we're that different from the ancients. I don't think 5,000 years is any time at all in the overall development of man. So I think we're almost identical, if not identical. So I see that as positive, because I think that allows us to be as consciously aware and as they were. I'd have to get into, you know, my view of progress in history and engineering to try to give you a sense of why at the moment we're not as, we in the Western civilization aren't so attuned to that consciousness as they might have been. But I've met people in my own life that I feel, you know, were represented a higher level of consciousness that I normally proceed in. So I don't think they're that different. I think we're the same. I think with effort and energy, we could be quite different. Now, where we as a civilization go, Western civilization go, that's a bit of a challenge. But you mentioned earlier Eastern religions. There are pockets, I think, of people that know this as well now as they did back then. And we just have to find them. We have to make use of them. We have to put that work into ourselves.
Okay. I gave you my interpretation of your work, the takeaway, the bottom line. What would you like the reader, both you and Lloyd, to, what would you like the reader to take away from your book?
Well, the important thing is to stop dismissing ancient writings and myths as fairy tales and approach them as valuable pieces of our culture that can give us some language that, as I tried to express, that helps us personally today understand what goes on within us, what can go on within us, where we might be going. We're hoping the book will at least open that option for people so that they can become personally engaged in these myths, this literature, so that they might be able to bring that to their own personal development, you know, and development of awareness and consciousness and self, you know, with the capital S. Hidden in plain view comes to mind. I mean, what we're finding is not that it's, you know, it's not esoteric in the sense that it's locked away in a lead container somewhere. It's just that we don't know how to approach them in a way that we could actually make use of it. And obviously, it's only one book, so we're just sort of introducing that idea that hopefully will allow other people to go back to some of the literature they're aware of. And it doesn't have to be Egyptian or Sumerian. I think there's many other, you know, Buddhist texts and whatnot that could be, could address this this desire for improvement. But yeah, this dismissal thing of, well, you know, again, naked people in the garden and a snake. Yeah, that you can tell that tale over and over again. But okay, well, what does it really mean, and how can I use it today as I talk to Cliff on the phone, that sort of thing.
Interesting. I'm not sure you can answer this last question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. Do you think our after your research, you and Lloyd wrote this book, do you think our current evolution, our where we're going right now as a highly civilized culture, is on a correct path to higher consciousness, or do you think we need to make adjustments so that we continue as a sophisticated society, but maybe we look to the inner self through meditative practice, through reading myths, through whatever, to have more of the human equation involved with all this high technology?
Yeah, where is high technology taking us? You're certainly aware of Göbekli Tepe, right?
You spoke about it many times.
Right. One of the most intriguing pieces of that site for me is, and I haven't been there yet, is the fact that it was built by hunter-gatherers. And one of the misconceptions I'd always been given is that, well, hunter-gatherers were poor, measly, died young. I've been reading a bit recently that may not have been the case, and that hunter-gatherers were a very powerful culture, i.e. they could build something out of megalithic stones in Göbekli Tepe 10,000 years ago, which is 5,000 years before the Sumerian myths I'm talking about. So at the moment, I'm questioning even whether agriculture and settlements are as necessary for human development as I've been taught. Definitely, we live in a city, in a system that, you know, possession, we own the land, and we have to own the land to grow food, whereas hunter-gatherers, at a different time in the history of the world with fewer people and all that, it intrigues me that hunter-gatherers could be as successful in managing to move megalithic stones and carving and whatnot. So I'm not going to make any prediction of where we're going, but I think there are other opportunities, other ways of looking at life that maybe don't, include cars and traffic jams and stress and all that. There was a book by on the Okinawa people in Japan. They're some of the oldest living people as a culture still in the world. And one of the final chapters says that one of the key pieces of the success of that culture and their aging is that apparently, they all get together to watch the sunset every evening. And I don't know that. I mean, I can't imagine that. But it's intriguing to think that a sunset would be more valuable than a six-figure salary. I see my answer to your question is quite broad. I don't know, but I think we have to look a lot broader than whether, you know, another spaceship is going to take us anywhere.
Interesting. Yeah, fantastic. The book is Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. And my guest today has been Paul Boudreau. And he co-wrote the book with Lloyd Dickey. And I guess it came out a few weeks ago. And I know it's on Amazon. Is it available in digital form on Amazon yet? Do you know?
Yep, the ebook is out there.
The ebook. Okay. Okay.
And we've got a lot of stuff online. If people are interested, they can do a Google or Bing search for AHICO, AWHICO, the first two letters of Awakening Higher Consciousness, AWHICO. And we've got Facebook and Twitter, LinkedIn. We've got our own website at awhico.com. And we've posted a few blogs that explore some of the topics we've gone through today. And, of course, you know, we'd love to hear from you. The contacts are online with the various social media tools.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are you guys going to be speaking anywhere you want to post to let us know about? Any conferences that people can attend coming up that where you talk a little bit about awaken higher consciousness?
Not at the moment. We're just getting settled with getting the books and we'll have to see later in the summer. I'm planning a motorcycle ride down to the States, and who knows what's going to come out of that.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I'll definitely post. Definitely post your website on our Facebook page and with a couple of photographs from the book. Best of luck to you. I think that you've probably triggered the beginning of a continual exploration on the subject. And look forward to seeing and reading more about your work, your future work.
That's great. It's been a lot of fun, Cliff. I hope I made some sense. And that's what we're all about, is promoting additional work. It's never going to be over.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic look at mythology, and I think it has an important place. And I encourage my audience to definitely take a look at it. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
All right. So, that is Paul Boudreau, and that is a great book. Awakening Higher Consciousness. Check it out. I actually got from the publisher an early digital version, which I'm beginning to enjoy. It took me a while to get into digital books because they don't obviously move the same way as pages. It's a you have to click a pointer to get to each page, but the material is the same, and it is an interesting read. Okay, next week my guest is Ram Ad Flem, who has written a book on Moses. If you remember, Rand is the author of a book on Atlantis. His early book was fascinating. This book is by Rose Ann Rand Flem on the story of Moses and how he died, and I think it's a very interesting subject. As always, I encourage you to take a look at our Facebook page. I will be posting some photos, as I mentioned, from Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer, as well as each day there's something new to post, and so always take a look at it. It's Facebook, Earth Ancients, and also I encourage you to take a look at the blog page, which has a lot of original writing, my own points of view, as well as those of the over 10,000 members. So have a look at that on Facebook. I'm hoping for the Earth Ancients website to be up in a few weeks. We're getting down to the final bits and pieces of intricate website. So I will be announcing that. And that site will be very sophisticated with photographs of my own, as well as a number of contributing photographers, scientists, and writers, and research investigators. So be looking forward to that. And again, I'll mention that again in the coming days. Have a great day.